Welcome to the Fit Physician Podcast, the busy women doctor's go-to resource to take your strength, fitness, and confidence to levels you never thought imaginable. You spent your life dedicated to the health of others. It's time to prioritize your own. Now, your hosts.
Hello, and welcome back to another episode of the Fit Physician Podcast. In this episode, we are following up episode number 5 on the topic of protein intake. In episode 5, Suzanne talked all about different facts and debunked some fiction when it comes to your protein intake and why it is so important to optimize protein to get the best out of your workouts, but also too for longevity. In this episode, we have gathered a list of the top questions from members of our free Fit Physician Kickstart Facebook group, as well as members in the Fit Physician Coaching Program who have asked questions recently in their office hours with Suzanne. Before we get to that, say hi to Suzanne. How are we doing?
We're great. I'm excited to be back. Was really thrilled to see the response to the protein podcast that we did and super excited to answer everyone's questions.
And do what you do best and nerd out a little bit more about nutrition.
Love it.
Awesome. So the first question we have is from Julia asking, how do you get 130 grams of protein in a day? How do you stay within your calorie budget in doing so and do so in what you've described as a pretty easy manner?
Yeah, that's a great question and one that I'm frequently answering with our clients. First, I just want to say again, bear in mind, ladies, you know, nutrition has been a passion of mine for decades, and it's a work in progress and has been a work in progress for decades and continues to be. So again, getting my adequate amounts of protein is quite simple for me, but it's because it has been, you know, it's taken work and effort and figuring out, you know, what works for me and what doesn't over time. So again, I don't want anyone to feel overwhelmed like this is something that happens overnight, but I promise if you continue to put in the effort and, you know, make the changes that over time it does become quite a bit less effortful. And for me personally, you know, hitting 130 grams a day is relatively easy, even without any sort of protein supplements, just because, like I said, it's been, you know, tried and tested over years and years and years of what works and what doesn't. So what does my day look like? It generally always starts with a very high protein breakfast, mainly because I wake up and I have my morning coffee and I do my workout. By the time I'm done my workout, I'm hungry. So first, I should start by saying I do eat animal-based proteins as well as plant-based. So I am an omnivore. So many of my sources will come from both. So the way I start my day is always with some form of eggs. I'm also tend to be a creature of habit, and I tend to not get sick of things too easily. And honestly, eggs are something I just do not get sick of. I do like to prepare them in different ways. So, you know, it can sometimes be fried eggs, sometimes it's an egg scramble, sometimes it's hard-boiled eggs, sometimes it's frittatas. But generally speaking, I generally start my day with some sort of egg-based breakfast. I try to optimize my protein by adding yummy, delicious things to the eggs. That's probably part of the reason I don't get bored of them. So I always tend to add to my eggs some sort of dairy. So sometimes it may be goat cheese, feta cheese, cheddar cheese, some sort of cheese source. I always add lots of veggies. So handfuls of spinach, lots of peppers, tomatoes, things like that. That's how I help with my fiber. And then if I do have any sort of leftover or protein, extra protein around, perhaps some cooked up chicken breasts, ground turkey, things like that, they all often add in a portion of that just to bump up the protein. And I also love to add, you know, when possible, when it's going to taste right, black beans, great source of protein and fiber as well. So I try to take the eggs as my base and plump them up. I also really enjoy Premier Protein Shakes, which is a protein drink as my dairy and sweetener in my coffee. So by using that between two cups of coffee, which is what I have every day, I use a third of the bottle of the container of the Premier Protein. So it works out to 10 grams of protein just in my coffee. So generally speaking, by the time I get out the door, I've had at least sort of 30, 40 grams. I also really try, I like toast with my eggs. I really am fussy about my toast having, you know, my bread sources having high protein, high fiber. So I like the Carbonaut, which is the particular type I use, 7 grams of protein and 7 grams of fiber per slice. So even in my 2 pieces of toast, I'm looking at, you know, 14 grams of protein right there. So easy for me to get anywhere between 30 to 50 grams of protein in the morning. My lunches generally consist of some sort of protein base with a salad side, often, you know, a veggie side as well, like a baked sweet potato, things like that. I love things like taco salads. I love salads with chicken breast on it, tuna, all of the things. So that's generally my lunch is what we know. And Jordan's side coined the big ass salad, you know, lots of veggies and a protein source. Again, adding dairy, adding legumes when appropriate, you know, would taste right, all of those things to top up the protein as well. Dinner, again, generally some sort of lean protein source. I love tuna steaks. I love ahi tuna bowls. We eat lots of chicken breasts in our family, lots of turkey breast, salmon, all of the things. Generally try to keep it lean with, again, sides, grilled vegetables, salads, things like that. So that's how I really do it. The one biggest trick that I found works for me is I do, in our family, I do protein prep. So, you know, meal prepping can be hard for me personally because I really don't have, you know, dedicated hours in my week to prepare full meals, including lunches, dinners, and things for the week ahead. But I do find that protein prepping really doesn't take much time. So when I'm making dinner on a Sunday night or Monday night, you know, I'll often, while I'm prepping the dinner, I may throw some extra chicken breast, you know, on the barbecue. I may put some chicken thighs in the air fryer. I may, you know, grill up some extra ground turkey, things like that. And then I just keep them all in containers. So at any point, I have my points of protein to just add to whatever I'm having, whether it be my salad, my eggs, and all of those things. I do find that having protein prepared ahead of time really is helpful for helping me meet my goals. The other trick I find is just, again, some simple replacements. So in our house, we buy high protein milk. So you can buy different types of brands of milk that have upwards to 18 grams per cup of protein. So that is fabulous. You know, again, anytime I'm using any milk products, it's always the high protein milk. I also have substituted anything basically white in my diet, like sour cream wise, with Greek yogurt. So I make my salad dressings with Greek yogurt, make my vegetable dips with Greek yogurt, anything that calls for sour cream, it's Greek yogurt as well. So again, by subbing these simple things out, it really doesn't change the flavor. Often, in my opinion, it makes the flavor much better, but it increases, it pumps up that protein. So without really thinking about it, I'm easily at 130 grams. If I'm really pushing my muscle gain, you know, goals, and I'm pushing upwards to the 150 gram mark, often I will supplement with a protein supplement just to make it a little bit easier for me. But the 130 grams are relatively easy just with those simple hints.
Yeah, totally. Great tips and great advice there. And for myself, I definitely stole, I actually had it today in my lunch wraps, the Greek yogurt tip and trick. And the other thing that I really like to do is you talked about protein prep. And what I like to do is go to Costco and just make sure, you know, I have all my favorite protein sources that I buy from Costco. And then you have stuff in the freezer. And so you can just plan out your meals based on how you're feeling. Just pull something out of the freezer that morning. You know, you're going to cook it in the evening is a big tip and a big trick that I have for anyone who's struggling. And another thing too, if you find that you're getting bored of your protein intake, one of the things that I've tried to follow is just mixing up throughout the day. So if I have chicken for lunch, I'm trying not to have chicken for dinner and so on and so forth, just having that variety. Or if I had chicken on Monday night, then I'm not trying to have that again on Tuesday night, just having that variety. So you're always keeping things spicy. So with that, that moves on to our next question. And let's go with a question from Amy. Where does the 0.8 grams per pound body weight come from?
Yeah, so it comes actually from a really wide body of literature. Again, the studies are innumerable. I can post a few links quoting sort of the rationale and where this is coming from. But basically, I mean, there are numerous studies. I couldn't list them all, but basically the wide body of evidence, sort of this has come to the consensus. The other thing about the 0.8 grams, there was actually a recent study, which was really interesting for all of our plant-based listeners out there. And it actually showed 0.8 grams per pound seems to be the magic number for stimulating muscle protein synthesis, regardless of your diet types. Meaning, if you can reach the 0.8 gram per pound target, even if it's all coming from plant-based proteins, you are getting sufficient amounts to adequately and optimally, not even adequately, optimally trigger your muscle protein synthesis and activate that. And it doesn't matter, like I said, whether it's all coming plant-based or even if the sources are complete or incomplete, which is what we talked about before, you are getting what you need. So that 0.8 grams per pound really is the amount that has been deemed optimal. I keep on wanting to use adequate, and it's optimal for stimulating muscle protein synthesis. Obviously, it can be higher. And as we get older, it actually becomes higher. But for the general population, you know, of people age 60 and below, it is the number that the evidence has best supported.
Yeah, awesome. And so I think you just answered Corrali's question, which was, are all protein sources created equal? Or should I be trying to prioritize different sources and have different types, like maybe some beans, some dairy, some meat, whatever it might be, to have this mixture to optimize my intake? Or am I just trying to reach that number?
Yeah, so great question. No, not all protein sources are equal, meaning they all come with a different profile of amino acids, particularly, again, it's the essential amino acids in our diet that we pay most close attention to, because those are what we need to get from our diet that we can't make ourselves. Every protein source, whether it be animal or plant-based, comes with a different profile of essential amino acids. And actually, Dr. Don Lehman, who is sort of one of the leading researchers in protein nutrition, is actually working with, he's got a working group right now, actually looking to basically give protein a quality score. So when you look at a protein source, you can actually see, you know, how high of a quality of protein that is. And that's based on its digestibility, absorption rates, you know, how well your body can absorb it. And it's also, it's an essential amino acid profile. So that's obviously not there yet. And I don't want to bog you down with the confusion, but it just goes to show you, no, not every protein is created equal. The one thing I would say is, if you are able to get the 0.8 grams per pound, then you really are ticking most of your boxes when it comes to what you need from the protein in your nutrition. And you really don't have to get bogged down with the finer details in the weeds. Like, you really are getting, regardless, as I said before, in that most recent study, which I can link in the show notes to, really does show that if you can get the total amount, the where it comes from, the when you take it in, you know, what time of day, all of those things matter much less. If you are somebody who's like, you know what, I'm never going to get there. I just don't want to. I don't like to eat that much protein. I have no intention of eating that much protein. If you are never, ever going to get to the 0.8 gram per pound, and you've just accepted that, which is fine, then all of a sudden those smaller details matter. So what types of protein matter? You need to make sure you're getting your essential amino acids. So starting to pay attention to more complete protein sources that get, you know, have everything you need becomes more important. The whens become more important. We know, you know, higher protein breakfasts really do help stimulate muscle protein synthesis for the day. So if you're not getting your total amount in the day, the where it's coming from and when you're taking it in does start to matter. And again, we can go into a whole thing about that, which I'm not necessarily saying is now is the time or place. But generally speaking, to anyone who's listening, if you're getting the 0.8 grams per pound, honestly, I would just sleep well at night, know that you're getting what you need, and not get too fussed about the rest. And ideally, hopefully, you're getting it in ways that you enjoy and, you know, that fit your lifestyle, fit your preferences, and just feel good about that.
Yeah, awesome. And so this question, it comes from many of our members and those that you've worked with in the Fit Physician program and coached through, is a lot of members come to us with a goal of weight loss. And when they start to look and monitor their nutrition, they are trying to reduce their calories and also to increase their protein intake. If you have someone who's struggling to get to that 0.8 grams per pound body weight and stay within their calorie budget, and their main goal is weight loss, what would be your advice to that person? What would you have them focus on?
So again, as you said, super common question. So, and this is where we get down into the finer details. when we're talking about weight loss, like if your whole priority is just to see that number, you know, get smaller on the scale, and that is what you want, it really does have to come, it really comes down to the energy deficit, right? Getting into that calorie deficit, that's what matters most. It will always matter most. If your main goal is body recomposition, which is a word I use, where we're looking to lose fat but preserve muscle mass, then both really do matter. Now, that being said, will you lose fat if you are not in a calorie deficit but eating enough protein? No, you will not. That's just the reality. If you are in a calorie deficit and not eating enough protein, you will lose fat, but you will most likely lose some muscle too. So again, when people are coming to me with this question, I'm struggling to get into my deficit and hit my protein. Obviously, a lot of it is going to be coaching into, you know, the best foods that come with the best protein to calorie ratio, meaning the highest protein for the least amount of calories. Those foods exist, and getting, you know, keeping them in your diet more frequently and in abundance will help you achieve your goals, your body recomposition goals. But if it comes down to right now, I can't do both, then the first thing I look at is perhaps going into less of a deficit, meaning maybe we slow down the fat loss in order to preserve the muscle. So for instance, if somebody is eating, let's say, you know, 1800 calories a day and losing a pound a week, but they're struggling in that 1800 to meet their protein goals, I'll be like, let's slow things down a little bit. So let's give you, you know, we'll keep you in a deficit. Let's say we bump you up to 2000 calories, that would have you losing about a half a pound a week. And so that we give you those extra calories so you can meet your protein. Like maybe we just slow down the fat loss, keep the deficit less dramatic to give you more room to eat the protein. Again, this is where these answering these questions is a little nuanced because it depends on person to person. But ideally, if you want to lose fat, there is no way around the calorie deficit part. There just isn't. If you want to preserve your muscle, really optimizing your protein is necessary. So ideally, it's finding, again, those foods and the pattern of eating that allows you to do both, which is where the one-on-one coaching can be really helpful. And you know, that's where we spend a lot of time trying to figure out where those foods are that will help them balance both budgets, because it can be challenging for sure.
Yeah. Awesome. And I'm going to backpedal to something that you alluded to earlier in this conversation, which was once we get past 60, you mentioned that we need to increase our protein intake. And Lisa's question is it true that we need more protein as we get older?
It is, which is probably surprising for a lot of people to hear because it's not what we see, right? Intuitively, we see as we get older, we see it in our own parents, our aging parents, they eat less and less, right? But we also see them in many cases getting more and more frail. So it's surprising to hear we should be eating more, but it's not surprising to hear it as well, because we see the outcomes of, you know, not optimizing our protein. So why is it that we need more? So essentially, in order for our body to function day by day, it needs about 300 grams of protein. This is always a shocking number to hear, but 300 grams of protein per day to get the essential and non-essential amino acids it needs to just perform life. So our muscles are constantly turning over, the building up, breaking down, building up, just like our bones. And what happens is when our muscles break down, when we're younger, our body is actually quite good at recycling the amino acids that are released during the muscle breakdown. So reusing them. So even though our body needs 300 grams, it doesn't all need to come from our diet, thank goodness. You know, our body is able to reuse, recycle the amino acids that are released during that muscle breakdown. Unfortunately, as we get older, our body's capability to reuse and recycle those amino acids becomes less and less and less efficient. So out of that 300 grams, more and more and more of it needs to come from our diet as we get older. So generally speaking, we really need to be prioritizing even more protein as we get older, provided we have normal, healthy kidneys, obviously, and no you know, chronic kidney disease as we get older. We really do need to prioritize that protein. So, you know, for me personally speaking, anyone sort of getting closer to 60, 60 and above, I really am encouraging closer to the 1 gram per pound of body weight to make sure that they're getting adequate amounts. Again, with the main goal being, you know, preservation of muscle mass at all costs as being incredibly important for your overall health span and lifespan. So no, we don't get to eat less protein as we get older. We actually need to eat more, which is why it's really important in our earlier decades, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. I mean, it's never too late to eat more protein, just like it's never too late to start, you know, weight training, right, Jake? It really, though, is key for it to become a really established pattern the earlier we are. So then it just gets easier. Like I'm already, so I'm 47 now, and I'm already starting to challenge myself a little bit to try to eat closer to the 150 grams so that I'm ready for it when I really need it, right? So that's where I'm already thinking towards and working towards. So again, it's just all the more reason to create a really good, strong foundation in your earlier decades so that it's not so monumentally, you know, difficult when you get to the older decades when it counts even more.
Yeah. And sticking with the longevity piece, Anna's question was, what do you make of the most recent study connecting high protein diets with cardiovascular disease?
Yes. I love that you asked this question. Thank you. I was hoping somebody would. So yeah, there was a recent study in Nature magazine or a magazine journal, which is a very reputable journal, that did show a possible link with high protein diets and cardiovascular disease. And as with any sort of nutrition study, there is always nuances, limitations, things to be discussed. So let's talk about the study. What essentially it showed, so again, to not nerd this out too much and to make it as digestible as possible, monocytes are a type of inflammatory cell in the body that are culprits to the inflammation that leads to heart disease. So inflammation in our vessels that can lead to heart disease. And what this study showed was that high protein diets, particularly diets high in leucine, stimulated the mTOR, which is the mammalian target of rapamycin. It's basically what initiates protein synthesis along with other pathways. It is stimulated mTOR in these monocytes, allowing them to live longer. So the idea is these inflammatory cells that can cause damage to our vessels, stimulating it with high protein diets allowed them to live longer, which essentially allowed them to do more damage. Okay. So in theory, at a cellular level, this could make sense, but we really, really have to be careful to make huge deductions on what happens at a cellular biochemical level compared to on our body at large. Okay. So in the study, there were three arms. One was done on mice, which I will talk about first. The other two were on humans. So the first one was done on mice. They were ApoE genetically modified mice. So these mice essentially get heart disease, and which is why they use them, right? They basically found mice that all of these mice get heart disease. And they found that the higher protein led to faster plaque formation in these mice. But first of all, comparing mice to animals is always difficult, right? There's always massive limitations, which I don't even have to explain. It's mice and we're humans. But on top of that, these genetically modified mice that are genetically predisposed to getting cardiovascular disease. Like, you're not going to tell me what's happening in this mouse that's going to get heart disease, like, you know, slam dunk, is going to be the same as what's happening to me. So obviously, massive limitations. There were two human arms to the study. They did look at the humans. But again, what they found was the immediate response to mTOR was in the monocytes. They didn't look at the long-term response. And really, that's what we need to look at. If we were to make huge deductions on the immediate response of what happens to our body in response to any macronutrient or other things, we would be making huge, hugely wrong conclusions when it comes to that. For example, what does exercise do? Exercise immediately. Following exercise, we have increased inflammation, we have increased heart rate, increased blood pressure, increased cortisol release. You could argue exercise is really bad for you at the cellular level in the short term, but no one's going to argue that it's bad for you, right? In the long-term benefits way to your overall body, way outweigh the benefits to the short-term biochemical changes that are happening at a cellular level. If you were to look at, you know, carbs, you know, carbs in the short term can increase inflammation and the insulin response. In the long term, provided you don't have diabetes or anything, the long-term response is very different, right? It all normalizes. If you look at fat, fat actually in the short term, when you first ingest fat, can actually decrease the amount of vasodilation, which can again be a risk for heart disease. So again, looking at long-term cellular, at this point, like what are we eating? We can't eat carbs, we can't eat fats, and we can't eat proteins, right? Again, every macronutrient has the ability to have positive effects and negative effects at a cellular level in the short term. It really is what it does, you know, overall to our body at large. And that study did not show that. So personally speaking, what I'm reading from the study is not changing my viewpoint on how much protein I personally ingest or how much that I feel is optimal for me. It was interesting, and you know, as all studies are, it was interesting, but it really didn't. Again, I'm not prepared to take what they were seeing at a short-term cellular level, and you know, having it change the way I really do believe is the, you know, the high protein diets optimizing your muscle mass, really the long-term health benefits to that.
Right, and I think this question from Michelle follows that up really well, where she read Dr. Atiti's book on longevity, and it would appear that stimulating mTOR in our body leads to aging. And yet, you mentioned the benefit of eating high levels of leucine, which also stimulates mTOR for muscle synthesis. So there's some confusion there. Is mTOR good or bad?
Yeah, super great question again, because even when I was reading Dr. Atiyah's book, again, big fan, even I was like, "Ooh, wait, stop. This isn't jiving." So confusion is to be expected based on this. So mTOR, again, the mammalian target of rapamycin, which has been indicated in it's has a role in the aging process, as Dr. Atiyah leads to in the book, and I won't go into great detail of that. It also is needed for the muscle protein synthesis pathway, basically to trigger us to grow muscle. I think the biggest difference to understand is the leucine in our diet, high leucine diets, it will stimulate mTOR in our skeletal muscle, right? In our muscles that where we want it to. It does not have the same response on our mTOR in our other tissues where it becomes to be, you know, more problematic. It really is targeting the mTOR in our skeletal muscle, which we want turned on. The other thing to bear in mind, as we know from Dr. Atiyah's book, who explained, you know, the science of it so beautifully, it really is it's the long-term signaling that we have to worry about mTOR, not the short-term. So when you have a meal high in leucine, there's that short-term burst where we turn mTOR on in our skeletal muscle, say, get ready to build muscle, like you have what you need, go for it, and then it turns off. Right? It's not chronically stimulated, which is what we are seeing as more of a problem in the aging process in our other tissues. It's that chronic stimulation. So when it comes to the high protein, like I said, short-term stimulation in the skeletal muscle, which is where we want it to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. Awesome. And Janelle's question was, how do you feel about collagen supplements and also to branched chain amino acid supplements outside of the diet? And I know that might be two different questions, but let's start with the collagen.
Yeah. So collagen, there's getting to be more and more robust evidence that there may be some benefit for it, for sure, when it comes to joint health in particular, and some benefits to that. So full disclosure to anyone listening, I didn't take it before and I'm starting to take it now because again, the evidence and probably the evidence has been there and maybe I just wasn't as up to date on it as I, again, this is me constantly just learning as I go. But from what I've done a deeper dive myself into collagen, and I do think there could be some benefit. And as a 47-year-old woman, I'll take it if it's there, particularly when it comes to my joint health. And hey, if it makes my skin look better, I'll go for it. But when it comes to actually, you know, using collagen, particularly to help with repair of connective tissue in the muscle post-workout, there's actually little evidence to that. There was actually a recent, I believe it was a meta-analysis, but don't quote me on that, that showed there wasn't quite enough benefit. So if you're looking to use it to, you know, repair the connective tissue in your skeletal muscle, particularly after a workout, no. If you think you might benefit from it from a joint point of view, then yes. The biggest thing I would say about collagen is it's not a complete source. So I wouldn't use it in replace of, let's say, a whey-based protein or soy-based, or, you know, as my main protein supplement source to get, because again, it is lacking, particularly, it's actually lacking in tryptophan. But so I wouldn't replace whey with collagen, but I probably, like, I am going to start adding it, meaning collagen, I'm going to start taking it as an add-on. But like I said, I wouldn't replace it with a more complete protein source. I would still keep that as my first choice.
Yeah.
When it comes to branched-chain amino acids, so that's basically where we're looking at the main essential amino acids. They, again, if you are getting enough protein in your diet in general, meaning that 0.8 grams per pound, I wouldn't worry about it. Feel free to take it if you want to, and you have the financial resources, you know, to not, it's not going to hurt you to lose money. There's no harm in taking it, is what I'm trying to say. I don't think you need them if you are getting that adequate amount. If you are not getting the adequate amount, and particularly if you are not getting the 0.8 grams per pound and you are vegan or plant-based, particularly vegan, meaning having no animal sources, including dairy, then I would recommend it, because I do think that they're important for topping you up on particularly the leucine that you need if you aren't able to get the 0.8 grams per pound from the food sources.
And our last question comes from Megan, which is, should I be worried if my kids take protein supplements, and can too much protein be bad for our little ones?
Yeah, no. So again, if your kids have healthy kidneys, which most kids do, and I hope that is the case for everybody listening, then no, you don't have to worry about the protein supplements. There's not going to be any harm in them. When I'm talking to parents, and obviously we coach a lot of moms, so this is a common question. My biggest thing is not that there's any damage, but again, sort of setting kids up with a really balanced, great relationship with food. Like, kids are obviously, a lot of the protein supplements, including protein bars, can taste quite delicious. And if you're a kid, right, with this yummy protein chocolate bar, and it's that or a chicken breast, we probably know which one the kid's going to go to. So it doesn't mean they're inherently bad. I just would sort of use caution that you're not setting up a habit that could be more difficult to break. Does that make sense? So, you know, again, I wouldn't use them as a main source of protein for my young children. Again, not because they're inherently bad or will cause damage, but ideally you want to be teaching them the most healthiest sort of relationship with food, which generally involves eating food from a variety of natural, you know, sources. So again, does that mean my kids would never have any sort of protein supplement? No, not at all. And if you're a parent out there struggling to get protein into your kids, again, don't feel bad. If that protein shake is how you're doing it, and the alternative is they don't get it, go with the protein shake. And I see it all the time, particularly in my practice and things, you know, kids who are really picky eaters, kids who are on stimulants, you know, perhaps, for their ADHD, that affects their appetite, where it really is hard to get calories and protein in at all. And where drinking sometimes is easier when they're not feeling hunger, they can often drink their calories and drink their protein. Then honestly, sometimes the protein supplements and the protein shakes and things are lifesavers. So again, it's an individual decision based on each child, but no, they are not inherently bad for children. And it's actually really interesting because in certain states right now, they're actually looking at changing the school program lunches to plant-based. And there's some concern that if not done correctly, that these young kids may be deficient, end up deficient in certain essential amino acids. Again, this is nothing anti-vegan. We know you can eat vegan and get everything you need, but it has to be thought out, right? So the concern is, you know, some of these school boards are doing this without actually properly thinking it out. And if these kids are not getting adequate amounts of the essential amino acid, particularly leucine, methionine, that it could actually set them up for significant health problems later in life. So again, this is none of the kids that are listening and our listeners, our kids are getting adequate amounts of protein. But should you not get adequate amounts of protein, it actually can set up your body to have a limited amount of muscle mass potential for the rest of its life, which obviously leads to, you know, increased risk of obesity and things like that. So I find it really interesting Because even when you look at some of these, milk alternatives, oat milk, almond milk, those kind of things, they're significantly less than some of these essential amino acids, particularly methionine. And, you know, so simply replacing a cow's milk with an almond milk, it's not equal. And I think some parents are doing it having no idea, you know, what they're with good intention without actually really understanding what they're getting more of or what they're getting less of. So I find the whole thing really interesting. And again, this is not at all to say that, you know, a vegan diet leads to these deficiencies, but it has to be well thought out. So when you're looking at little kitties and making these big swaps, you want to do it carefully for sure.
Right. And I think, you know, two things that I take away from, I always learn something new when I hear you chat about nutrition. So thank you for that. And thank you for educating us all. But two things that I take away from any time I am hearing you either coach someone or talk on a podcast or just talk about nutrition in general is that so much of what's out there is you really have to take it, absorb it, and understand how to make it work for you or for the individual that you're coaching. And the other thing that, you know, I admire you so much for is that you are sharing the knowledge that you have based on the evidence that you've attained and your previous knowledge and everything that you've learned, but you're also not afraid to say, you know what, there's new evidence that's come out, or I've learned something about this study or whatever it might be that's changed my tune on that. And so for any of our listeners, just knowing that, as I say to anyone new coming into the Fit Physician program who's not familiar with Suzanne, as you can tell, she has a wealth of knowledge when it comes to nutrition and the best in the game from anyone that I've seen, worked with, followed on Instagram. But just keeping in mind that anything that you take in and anything that you consume is based on what's out there, the evidence that she's consumed, her knowledge, and her coaching experiences.
Thanks, Jake. Yeah. And like I said, it's nutrition. Medicine, which our listeners, our physician listeners, it is a constant, and that's what we love about our career. It's constant learning, right? It's constantly learning new skills, challenging the way we see things based on new evidence. And nutrition is the exact same, which is probably why I love the two so much. And they both, you know, give me, you know, so much drive and really are my passion. It's constantly learning and trying new things and being willing to change your mind. And really, that's the key. And it's what I always say, if you are listening to anyone, getting nutrition advice from anyone, myself included, make sure who you're listening to is willing to change their mind. Because if they're not, if they're really stuck in their way of thinking, then unfortunately, the information and how it's provided to you will end up being biased and will end up not being, you know, as up to date or as truly evidence-based as they may say. So yes, changing our mind. I could do a whole podcast on the things I've changed my mind, and maybe that's a good idea one day.
Yeah.
And on nutrition things and how I've changed my mind over the years based on the evidence.
Yeah, so good. I think we've covered the topic of protein in pretty good depth. And like you said, there's more that we could go into, but for now, more topics to come and more great episodes will be released in the very near future. So keep checking out the Fit Physician podcast. And thank you again, Suzanne, for your time.
Have a great day.
Thank you for listening to the Fit Physician podcast. We invite you to head over to thefitphysician.com for more free resources and to learn more about how to work with us in becoming your strongest, fittest, most confident self.
The information provided in this podcast is for general informational purposes only and is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Always seek the advice of your physician or other qualified health provider with any questions you may have regarding a medical condition. I am a medical doctor, but not your medical doctor. Never disregard professional medical advice or delay in seeking it because of something you have heard on this podcast. The hosts, guests, and producers of this podcast do not provide medical advice or services. The content of this podcast, such as text, graphics, images, and any other materials, are for informational purposes only. Reliance on any information provided by this podcast is solely at your own risk. The podcast hosts, guests, and producers do not endorse any specific tests, physicians, products, procedures, opinions, or other information that may be mentioned on the podcast. Mention of any specific information does not imply endorsement or recommendation by the hosts, guests, or producers. By listening to this podcast, you agree to the terms of this disclaimer.